From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Monday when a nurse at a hospital in Queens made history. Sandra Lindsay is the director of critical care nursing at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. She's also the first person in the United States to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. New York is now a week into phase one of the distribution process, with healthcare workers and, as of yesterday, nursing home residents and staff receiving vaccines. Governor Andrew Cuomo said that as of Monday at noon, 38,000 New Yorkers received injections. The state has a five-phase plan prioritized by risk, also prioritized by maintenance of essential services and community prevalence of COVID-19. We'll talk about those phases this hour because we know many of you are wondering when it will be your turn, where you need to go, and what you should expect. We also know that many people in the community have questions about the vaccines themselves. How do they work? How were they developed? And are they safe, knowing they were developed in record time? The answer is yes. Now is the time for clear, transparent communication about the vaccines. They are our way out of this pandemic. We know there's a lot to understand. It may be overwhelming or confusing and brand new information for many of us. We also know that there's mistrust and fear of the vaccine among some people of color based on decades of discrimination and abuse in medical research. That's why Nurse Sandra Lindsay, who is African-American, volunteered to get the vaccine first. In her words, quote, "to inspire people who look like me, who are skeptical in general about taking vaccines," unquote. So this hour is an opportunity to hear from the experts, to ask them your questions, to share your concerns, and to have an informed conversation based in science. I'm so grateful for the work of my guests and for them taking the time to join me today. I'd like to welcome Dr. Nancy Bennett, director of the Center for Community Health and Prevention and co-director of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute at the University of Rochester Medical Center, who last week was also tapped to lead or co-lead Monroe County's Vaccine Distribution Task Force. Dr. Bennett, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Ann Falsey is here as well. She's an infectious disease specialist with Rochester Regional Health, professor in the Department of Medicine, Infectious Diseases at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and co-director of the URMC Vaccine and Treatment Evaluation Unit. Dr. Falsey, welcome back to you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to say again how grateful I am for your time, both of you. I know you're very busy. I think this is a really important public service. And so thank you again for being here. I'll also say we were flooded with questions. I've got 10 pages of questions for you, and I'm sure we're going to hear from our listeners as well. So we will be very busy this hour. And before we start some of those questions, just again, listeners, you can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email your questions to connections@WXXI.org. So we'll dive into some of those questions shortly. But first, Dr. Falsey, we're hearing a lot about the new strain of the virus identified in the UK. Listeners, if you were just with us on NPR, you heard some of that. This strain appears to be more contagious than the one we've been dealing with since March here in the U.S. What do we know at this stage?
So what we know is there is a new strain. There are, I believe, 17 mutations in the virus, and that it is occurring during a period of time where there's extremely high transmission in the UK. I believe that there is a presumption that it is more transmissible, but I don't know that there's actual scientific evidence that it replicates more efficiently in the upper airways or people have higher titers. Those studies, I think, are yet to be done, but there's reasonable concern that that is true.
The New York Times reported, I believe yesterday, that some scientists say the increase in transmission could be related to how the strain of this virus infects children. And it reports, quote, "normally children are less likely than teenagers or adults to get infected or pass on the virus, but the new strain may make children as equally susceptible as adults." That's according to Wendy Barclay, government advisor and virologist at the Imperial College of London. What do we know about this new strain in kids, Dr. Falsey?
So I'm afraid I don't know anything about the strain in children. It has not been reported if it's circulating more widely amongst kids in the UK. So if she were to say that, I would, you know, I'm not sure whether she's making a hypothesis or she actually has some data that's not been published.
I think that's a fair point. I think often we're hearing throughout this pandemic, we don't know yet. And that doesn't mean we don't know or we won't know ever, but there's still so much research that has to be done. What would you say to people, Dr. Falzi, who are anxious, who are concerned, who are hoping that we'll find more information faster? What are we learning about the process and how this is evolving in real time?
Well, you know, I think the process is moving amazingly quickly and that the public is, in fact, getting good information quickly. But I think that there has to be some understanding and some patience that sometimes things will change. And that isn't necessarily that anybody wasn't being transparent. It's just that the new information changes how we think.
A couple more questions about this new strain, because some of our listeners are asking for more information. Yesterday during his press briefing, Governor Cuomo said he believes that the strain of the virus is already here in the U.S. Dr. Fauci just told the same to NPR. And this has not yet been confirmed by scientists. Should we be concerned at this stage, Dr. Falzi?
Well, you know, given the fact that we live in a world that with extensive travel, I think it would be naive to think it's probably not already here. Is it the prevalent strain? I think that's unlikely, but we won't know until we do the sequencing studies to actually get the data.
Do we know much about if the vaccine that's the vaccines that are currently being administered for the strain we're dealing with right now in the U.S. might work against the new strain?
We believe so. And one of the fortunate aspects of the vaccines that are moving forward is that they give the code for the entire gene for the whole spike protein. And on that protein are a number of different spots that the immune system can react to. So if one place may mutate, there's plenty of other places that your body is making antibody to so that the vaccine should be effective. We do know that the strain that began in Wuhan mutated somewhat when it got to Europe, and the European strain has become the dominant strain throughout the world. And there's been enough time, so we have been able to look at the antibodies generated by the vaccines, and they do inactivate or neutralize that virus as well. So I think there's every reason to be optimistic that the vaccine should work just fine.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on developments related to that new strain, but let's transition back to questions about the current COVID-19 vaccines. And I'd like to turn to one from a listener named Julie, who has a question about vaccine distribution in nursing homes, which began yesterday. And she asks, how is the rollout going with nursing homes and senior facilities in the area? Does the term nursing home include assisted living and or memory care? Dr. Bennett, I'll turn that one to you.
Thanks so much. So we're learning very quickly about this system. As the listener may know, the arrangement has been really a national arrangement with a number of pharmacies to deliver vaccine in long-term care facilities. It's our understanding in our community that both skilled nursing facilities and assisted living facilities are included in this plan, but it's just gotten up and running. We're just finding out when various facilities are scheduled to receive their vaccine. And so we're just really learning how well this plan will work. One of the groups that is probably not covered by this plan is independent living facilities, and we will be thinking about how we can address those facilities as well. The plan currently is that a portion of the staff are vaccinated at the same time that residents are vaccinated. And then as the pharmacies come back for follow-up visits, they vaccinate more of the staff.
I know we're only a couple days into this process, but Dr. Bennett, what are you hearing from residents or staff members or people administering the vaccine about how things are going so far?
Honestly, I haven't heard a lot, just anecdotally that it's been going well, that many of our residents in nursing facilities and in assisted living are eager to get the vaccine. They've been watching the news just like we all have, and they would like to be protected. These are obviously very high-risk settings for patients. We know that In the first part of this epidemic, up to 40% or even more of the people who were hospitalized and died from this vaccine were residents of nursing homes. So I think, by and large, the vaccine is being greeted with lots of enthusiasm.
We've heard from healthcare workers who have been on this program in the last week or so who say they've been dancing, they've been celebrating, they're just so happy to have been vaccinated. Is that what you're seeing, Dr. Falzi, in the hospital?
Oh, definitely. I think that there is a definite shift in mood that, you know, we've been slogging through this pandemic for many months now, and it's hard not to get down and discouraged. And this feels like we're at a turning point. So many people, including myself, are very happy.
That's great. We have a number of questions from healthcare workers who'd like to know how their group in particular is being prioritized. They're, of course, in the first phase of the rollout. And I think one of the questions that I'm seeing sort of summarizes many of them. So I'll read it now. And this listener asks to remain anonymous. And they say, I'm an employee of Rochester Regional Immediate Care, an urgent care center affiliated with Rochester Regional. We have 7 sites throughout the Rochester area and evaluate between 400 and 600 patients a day for the COVID-19 virus. We have about 160 clinical staff, and there is apparently no plan for us to obtain the vaccine. As we are frontline individuals doing evaluations 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, I wonder what in the decision-making process for the vaccine rollout skipped our facility. And I know that's a very niche question, very particular to this particular facility. But Dr. Falzi or Dr. Bennett, whoever feels they can more adequately answer this question, how are decisions being made regarding how healthcare workers are prioritized? And how would you address this listener's question?
I can speak to that if you'd like. I can't speak to the specifics of your listener's question, but I can speak to the general framework, which is that each institution has received a certain amount of vaccine, and they have been prioritizing the delivery of that vaccine to their staff members based on the risk of their exposure to COVID. And I can't, again, you know, I don't know the specifics of the institution's priorities, but I do know that the principal has been level of risk. I think it's unlikely that urgent care centers that are affiliated with RRH would not be included in their prioritization process. I think the hospitals are prioritizing all of their employees, but it may be that they're not at the very top of the list. Relatively little vaccine has been received in our community so far. You know, most of the hospitals got about 1,000 doses last week. This week, as of yesterday, some of the Moderna vaccine is beginning to be delivered, but still, you know, really small numbers of doses compared to the numbers of healthcare workers.
Mm-hmm. And the only thing I would just add to that that sometimes people don't consider is the logistics, and I'm not sure about how things will roll out to urgent care centers and places that are off-site from the main hospital, but the two different vaccines have different storage requirements, and the Pfizer vaccine requires minus 80 freezers, so it may be that people on-site where we have the facilities to store the vaccine came first. With Moderna, however, there's the ability to use more standard freezers and refrigerators. So other things sometimes move into the decision, although I certainly agree with Dr. Bennett that the primary driver was a perception of risk of acquisition of the virus. And I appreciate this person's concern that, you know, in urgent care, certainly there's a lot of contact and certainly a potential for exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we have so many questions about how the timeline and priorities are determined. And Dr. Bennett, I'm going to ask you a question we asked you on last week's forum, which is probably unfair, but so many people want to know when the majority of the population will likely be vaccinated. I know this is an evolving situation, but what would you tell people who have that question?
Yeah, it is evolving, and it's so dependent on when we receive vaccine. just as a reminder, only two vaccines have been approved for emergency use authorization. So we're waiting to see what will happen with other vaccines that are currently in clinical trials. I think that it's going to be a slowish rollout. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. There's a huge amount of pressure now that vaccine is hitting the street to get it into people's arms as fast as possible. But there are many logistic challenges. So it's really hard to tell. I mean, you know, people much more expert than I are predicting spring into summer for the general population, because the general population, and that is those under 65 years of age who have no chronic conditions and are at no particular risk because of their employment, that group of people will come last. And, you know, I think that could be several months from now.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at New York's vaccine phases for listeners who have questions about where they may fall. You can find all this information on the state website. But to summarize it for you, phase one, which we're in now, healthcare workers in patient care settings, long-term care facility workers who regularly interact with residents, and most at-risk long-term care patients. Again, we're in that phase now. Phase two includes first responders, teachers and school staff who are in person, and child care providers, public health workers, and other essential frontline workers that regularly interact with the public or maintain critical infrastructure. Also in phase two, other long-term care facility patients and those living in other congregate settings, and individuals in the general population deemed particularly high risk due to comorbidities and health conditions. Phase three, individuals over 65 and individuals under 65 who have high risk comorbidities and health conditions. Phase four is all other essential workers. Phase five, as Dr. Bennett said, healthy adults and children. Many people are wondering where they fall in these phases. Dr. Bennett, I know you've been emphasizing, don't call your doctor. But for people who say, how do I know even which phase I fall in, or who is going to make the call? How do I find out where I should be on the list? What would you tell people with those questions?
Well, we hope to have a lot of this information repeated and out there for everyone to view. The State Health Department has set up a website, and so they're sort of out of the box. But I'm not sure that it has as much information on it at this time as people hope to see. We also hope to have a local website that will enable you to actually enter some information, and then we'll be told what stage you're in, essentially. And then when your stage is being addressed by the vaccination system across the community, we'll be able to actually notify you and tell you that you're up. We're hoping that this will take some of the pressure off the private physicians' offices and the clinics and hospitals, so that we'll be able to communicate directly with people rather than having, the constant phone calls and so forth. It is clear that, people are being, like right now, healthcare workers are being notified by their employers when they're up for being vaccinated, again, based on this hierarchy dependent on risk. As we move through the populations, obviously this becomes more complicated and it will be more public.
So essentially, don't call us, we'll call you. Be patient.
Yeah.
We're working on it. Again, it's
right,
evolving.
Right, exactly. I mean, I can't emphasize enough that there's really very little vaccine available yet. And so we're really trying to do the best job we possibly can of allocating that vaccine in the most equitable and transparent way. But, you know, there will be more vaccines soon, we hope.
Mm-hmm. Where will people likely go to get vaccinated? Will they go to their doctor's office, to a CVS, to a hospital setting?
All of the above. I think that we're going to be using all different ways of getting vaccine to members of our community. For some people, it will be through their doctor's office. For some people, it may be going to a pharmacy. For some people, it may be going to public clinics.
Mm-hmm. Here's a message from a listener in Wayne County who says, do I have to get the vaccine in the county where I live? I live a quarter mile into Wayne County. Dr. Bennett.
I don't think so. I think that the approach that's being taken is really a regional approach rather than a county-specific approach. There may be specific clinics that are set up by counties that will be limited to residents of that county. I can't speak to that yet. But for the most part, no, there won't be a limitation with respect to where you live.
Okay. And I also want to address an issue that has come up in the last week or so in this community. And it's tied to a question from Christopher, who says, I've heard concerns about there being mandatory vaccinations. Would you please address this issue? Some of these concerns have come from a member of Rochester City Council who is holding a march against mandatory vaccines sometime around, I think it's New Year's Day. That's Jose Pio. Mm-hmm. And yeah. He is saying that he's not marching against the vaccines themselves, but he's marching against a bill that has been introduced in the state assembly but has not moved forward. So before we talk about the mandatory issue, which is not an issue right now, as far as I understand, Rochester City Council President Loretta Scott has come out and says, and has said that some of the information that Council Member Pio is sharing regarding rumors about people being harmed or dying while the drug was being tested in trials, those are not true. Dr. Angela Branch was on this program last week and said no one has died from the vaccine in trials. So the information that you are seeing on Facebook that's being shared, again, doctors are saying that is not true. Dr. Bennett, what would you say to Christopher, who is asking us to address the mandatory vaccination issue?
Yeah, this has come up several times, and there are a number of important issues related to this. First of all, this vaccine currently is authorized under an emergency use authorization, and as part of that regulation, it cannot be mandated. So it is not possible for, under an EUA, to mandate receipt of this vaccine. So it's not at all an issue. But the second thing is that I don't think anyone in public health or in healthcare in general has any interest in forcing people to be vaccinated. Our goal is to give people the most information, try to really dispel the myths, and there are a lot of them, and ensure that people can make a choice about getting this vaccine or not. Those of us who are in healthcare are very enthusiastic about this vaccine and hope that everyone in the population will be, because we do need to get to a certain level of vaccination to ensure that we can protect our communities from this virus. But no one is suggesting that anyone be forced to be vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Falzy, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I think Dr. Bennett summed it up very well. It's very important to say that this rally that's going on is addressing a problem that doesn't exist. And as Dr. Bennett said, we encourage, we educate, we don't mandate. And even with influenza vaccine in hospital settings, we still have some healthcare workers that decline flu vaccine, and we ask them to wear a mask when flu is prevalent because they didn't get vaccinated, but we don't force anyone to receive a vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we move into some questions about the science behind the vaccine that I'll direct to Dr. Falzy, one last question for you, Dr. Bennett, on the prioritization and the timeline. Some people are asking how the timeline is determined when it comes to underlying conditions. How will it be determined which underlying conditions are more critical than others to address?
That's a great question. I think that probably what will happen is that we will take the underlying conditions that have been shown to put people at most risk of having a severe clinical course with COVID, and those will be the priority conditions initially. But, you know, as time goes on, that will be broadened, I'm sure. In terms of how we will determine who those people are, a lot of that probably will occur on a practice-by-practice basis. So physicians know who among their patients have chronic underlying conditions that would put them at heightened risk of COVID. And as our information systems improve, we're able to support physicians in identifying those patients. And those patients are likely to get the call a little sooner than patients who do not have those conditions.
Okay. Well, we're going to take our short break. And when we come back, we have so many more questions for the experts today, Dr. Nancy Bennett and Dr. Ann Falzi. We're going to talk about mRNA technology. We're going to talk about the effectiveness of the vaccines. More questions from our listeners. Again, if you have questions, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email connections at WXXI.org. I will say we are short-staffed today, so if you're on the line, hang with us. We will get to you as soon as we can. Short break, more connections next. Coming up in our second hour, a travel guide of sorts for the pandemic winter. For many of us, we won't see a vaccine until later next year, maybe summer, maybe earlier. But the bottom line is, we're looking at another pandemic winter where we might see some restrictions, where we will see physical distancing. So what can we do to make the best of it and socialize safely? We'll talk about a range of activities in the Rochester Finger Lakes region, outdoor sports, and more. This is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We are answering your questions about COVID-19 vaccines, and we're joined by Dr. Nancy Bennett, director of the Center for Community Health and Prevention and co-director of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute at the University of Rochester Medical Center. She's also the co-lead of Monroe County's Vaccine Distribution Task Force. And Dr. Ann Falzi, infectious disease specialist with Rochester Regional Health, professor in the Department of Medicine, Infectious Diseases at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and co-director of the URMC Vaccine and Treatment Evaluation Unit. Dr. Falzi, some questions for you about mRNA technology. There's some confusion among many listeners about how it works. And Tim says, can you please explain mRNA technology in layman's terms? Important, I believe, is that although this vaccine is new, the technology has been in development for years.
Yes, it's a good question, and we find that even explaining it to some of our physician friends requires some discussion. So RNA, when you inject the RNA as a vaccine, it basically gives your bodies the instructions to produce the protein, that spike protein, in your body's cells. So it's giving the message for your body to make the protein. And that way, the protein is made in a very natural shape and produces the best immune response. Many people get RNA and DNA confused, and that's one of the things that has created some anxiety. DNA is your body's blueprints for reproduction in your cells, and it's quite different than RNA. RNA actually cannot get into your nucleus, and that's where the DNA is. So this virus, this vaccine cannot integrate with your body's own DNA.
And the part about this being in development for years, Dr. Falzi, I think is important to emphasize because there's been concern. We talked to Jerry Lacks Y on this program, the granddaughter of Henrietta Lacks, and she said she's hesitant about the vaccine, not because of what has happened to her family, her grandmother, Henrietta Lacks, but because she's nervous about the vaccine being developed so quickly. And I think Evan Dawson used a metaphor on this program recently that I think a lot of people understood well, and I want to reiterate it. He was saying, say you read a recipe in a cookbook. It's for a cake. You want to make a cake from scratch. You print out the recipe. You understand it well. You go to the store. You get all the ingredients. You start mixing things. Perhaps this cake's being made for some party you're supposed to go to. And then you get a message. Your friends have canceled this party. Now you've got this cake batter sitting around. But then your neighbors call and they say, hey, want to come over for dinner? Maybe you can just bring dessert. You finish making this cake, you bring it over, and they say, how did you make this from scratch so quickly in less than an hour? Well, you were already in the process of doing this work. It was already done, the main steps. Do you think that's a good way to characterize some of this bench work that's being done or had been done, Dr. Falzi?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great analogy. So it's been at least 10 years that people have been working on RNA vaccines. They've been in clinical trials for cancer for a number of years. And one of the great RNA vaccine for influenza has been developed, although it's not licensed. And you're quite right that the technology was there. And one of the great things about the recombinant technology is you can swap out whatever, you know, organism, germ you need to protect against. So it was waiting to be to be used. But the other thing that's important to say is with this specific vaccine, all the usual steps were done. They were just done quickly and very efficiently with people working around the clock. It's just been an enormous global effort and millions of people working very hard. But they've done all the usual steps just at a rapid pace.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from a listener who says, do you have to have the flu shot as a prerequisite for the COVID vaccine?
No, you don't. We always encourage people to get their flu vaccine. We're not quite sure what the current COVID pandemic is doing to influenza activity in the community, but it is definitely not a prerequisite.
Mm-hmm. Kyle wants to know, we know kids can get infected, but have we seen greater severity in that more kids are being hospitalized? Is there a specific age range that predominantly is showing more illness?
So this vaccine is, this virus is very age-dependent, and we do know that very young children usually don't have any symptoms at all. And so as you get up in age to older children and adolescents, they tend to exhibit more in the way of symptoms. But it's important to note that serious disease and hospitalization in children and young people is still quite rare.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about the vaccine in kids at this point?
Well, we don't know a huge amount yet. We presume that it will also be safe and effective, that at least three of the trials have actively lowered the age limit to older children, so 12 and above. So we are just getting that information now.
Mm-hmm. We've seen a number of questions about the individual vaccines and individual physiologies. Here's a question from Douglas who says, how will our individual physiologies plug into which of these vaccines we should take, and will we have a choice?
Well, I think that we have so much left to learn. So I would not at this point be able to tell somebody, you know, you're good for an RNA vaccine, whereas you should probably get the protein vaccine. We don't know that yet, if there would be any specific risk factors or characteristics where somebody might respond better to one versus another. We do know with the two RNA vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer, that it seemed to work well against all the sort of ethnic diversity, racial diversity, age groups, and different chronic conditions. So we don't expect that there will be sort of designer vaccines for individual groups. You know, there will be new vaccines hopefully being approved, the AstraZeneca and the Janssen, maybe in January or February. But again, I think that the supply is so limited that at this point, my advice would be to just receive whichever vaccine becomes available to you.
My dental hygienist asked me this morning at my appointment, what do you think? Which one are you going to get? And I said, I'm going to get the first one that's offered to me, whenever that is. So
exactly.
Give me whatever you've got. I'm not going to be picky. Mm-hmm. We have some questions about side effects, and we'll get to those in just a moment. But Dr. Bennett, I know there's concern among the group that you're working with about, we need to make sure that people show up for that second dose for the vaccines that do require two doses. Let's talk a little bit about that. If you show up, you get your first shot, it's not enough. Can you emphasize that point?
Yes, it's not enough. I think that's the best way to say it. These vaccines are designed to be two-dose vaccines. There may be some later in the pipeline that will only be a single dose, but both of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines require two doses. There's a little bit of evidence of possibly some protection after the first dose, but certainly not complete protection. So it's going to be really critical that people come back for their second dose. And the plan currently is that when you get your first dose, you will be given or you will arrange an appointment for your second dose. The two vaccines have slightly different time ranges, but what's critical is that you get back for your second dose, even if you're a few days late. It's very, very important, and we can't emphasize it strongly enough that that if people only get one dose, we cannot assure that they will be protected.
How will that outreach go, Dr. Bennett, as you're talking to different groups in the community? We mentioned on our forum last week that Wade Norwood, CEO of Common Ground Health, said that he shares the concern about people showing up for that second dose because what we've seen in blood lead level testing among groups is people show up for that first year test and then they don't often for the second year test. What kind of public education is in the works to make sure people do receive both doses?
Yeah, there will be extensive public education, really at every level, I hope. I think we'll work with major media, we'll work with social media, we'll work on the ground with grassroots ways of communicating. And the second dose will always be an important part of that communication. I do think that this vaccination campaign will be a little bit different from anything we've ever done before. And as a consequence, I think that people will be more aware of their need for a second dose. We'll also try to ensure that we make it convenient for people. We want people to go back to the same place to get their second dose, ideally, because they also need to get their second dose from the same kind of vaccine they got the first time. Mm-hmm. So I think there will be a lot of work to ensure that people do show up for the second dose.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Falzy, here's a question from Luann who asks, regarding the risk of anaphylactic shock for people at risk, has the specific allergen been identified? I know that other vaccines are avoided for people with egg allergies because it's known that this is the allergy that is triggered. What do we know about allergies in the vaccines?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think we don't know anything definitively yet. There has been some. There's definitely no eggs in either vaccine, and notably, in none of the trials was there any anaphylactic reaction. So, it is a little curious that this has started to happen as the vaccine has rolled out. There has been some concern about polyethylene glycol, which is one of the very tiny components in the vaccine. So that's the stuff in what's called Go Lightly that colonoscopies prep. So I think at this point it's hard to say what is the exact component that some people have these severe allergic reactions to. But my caution would be individuals who have multiple severe allergic reactions should be cautious. They should definitely take the vaccine in a healthcare setting. But that for the majority of people that have a very specific allergy, like a peanut allergy or an egg allergy, there really is nothing like that in this vaccine.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at some data from the CDC that says more than 272,000 shots of the Pfizer vaccine were given nationwide as of Saturday morning. Only 6 cases of allergic reaction were reported as of Friday night, and that included one person with a history of vaccination reactions. So I think it's important to emphasize, right, as Dr. Falzy said, we're still learning, and people who have these kinds of allergies need to be aware, but this is not a major cause for concern. Is that true, Dr. Falzy, at this stage?
Yes, it really should not dissuade someone from getting the vaccine. All of life is risk and benefit, and we know that acquiring COVID is quite bad, and the risk of doing poorly is significant, and these vaccines are very safe.
Mm-hmm. That also leads into a conversation about side effects. Some people very concerned about the side effects they may see after being vaccinated. I'm looking at some data that the University of Rochester Medical Center provided us. 47% of people in the Pfizer trials saw fatigue. 42% saw headaches, 14% saw chills, 21% muscle pain, 4% fever, varying degrees of mild to moderate to severe there. That's after the first dose. The side effects after the second dose are slightly more elevated. But back to what you were saying, Dr. Falzy, about there's risk in everything. What would you tell people who are concerned about side effects and maybe thinking, I don't want those side effects, so maybe I'll skip the vaccine?
Yeah, I would say that the side effects are quite mild to modest, being fatigued for a day is, again, really nothing like catching COVID and getting quite sick from it. So from my experience and from reviewing the literature, the side effects, side effect profile is actually quite good, that people tolerate the vaccine very well. I think that some of the concern with certain individuals is when you can get a low-grade fever, and it may cause issues with going to work the next day, because we all have to, you know, sign in and fill out that we don't have any COVID-like symptoms, and sometimes that creates a bit of anxiety for people, but they should discuss it with their employer, because mm-hmm. getting a COVID vaccine overall is much better for the workplace than going unprotected.
Yeah, we had a conversation on this program last week of, you know, maybe having your employer giving you a day off is a sign of solidarity, people getting vaccinated, protecting yourself, protecting others. There's a lot we're still learning, but I think it's important to convey there are side effects for some people. They're manageable. You know, you may have one day where you're fatigued or where you have a fever, but as Dr. Falzi said, on the whole, that's so much better than getting COVID and dealing with COVID.
Right. And generally, one dose of Tylenol or ibuprofen seems to really take care of it. People feel fine and within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. We're down to our last 10-ish minutes on the program. I'm going to try to get through as many listener questions as possible. This question comes from John. It goes back to what Dr. Bennett was talking about regarding that second dose. He says, if supplier distribution problems arise, what impact on the effectiveness will there be if the second dose isn't administered on that 21-day schedule? How far out before it is ineffectual? Do we know that at this stage?
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that question, but generally speaking, we think there's a fair amount of wiggle room around the timing of the second dose. And so while we'd like people to get it on time, if there is some delay, people should still get it. There wouldn't be a point at which we would tell people not to get their second dose. So we'll have to see. We don't, you know, we just don't have that information from the trials, because obviously in the trials, people got their doses on time for the most part. Usually what happens in this scenario is that as vaccine is rolled out into a community, you know, in this case, a two-dose vaccine, eventually there will be some people for whom their dose is given late, and we will be able to study that. But currently, we simply don't have those data, and we do really want people to try their very best to get their dose on time.
Mm-hmm. Rob says, my mom is 81. Is there a way to get her vaccine sooner? She's at home, not at a nursing home.
No. No, she will be among the fairly high, you know, one of the groups that's been sort of elevated in the phasing has been those who are over the age of 75. There's been recognition that these people are at higher risk, and so we are hoping that people over the age of 75 will be getting the vaccine a little sooner than we originally anticipated. And that was a change that came from the ACIP last weekend.
Mm-hmm. Claudia says, when the test groups were run and then went about their lives, how did they know whether the test groups were indeed exposed to COVID? Dr. Falzi.
Yeah, so in enrolling subjects into these trials, it was one of the entry criteria that you had to have some risk of acquiring coronavirus. And so, specifically, first responders, essential workers, people that were out there in the community mixing, just because of circumstance or their employment, they had to be out there. Were the people that were enrolled into the trials. So that was done on screening. What they did with their behavior after that, we certainly advised all of our volunteers to stay safe, to wear a mask, to social distance, but they were out there circulating. And even if people felt like, oh, gosh, I got that vaccine because I got a little fever the next day, we counseled them extensively that they really shouldn't change their behavior. No bar hopping without masks, mm-hmm. just because you think you got the vaccine.
Audrey says, I've seen a lot of worry about whether the vaccine is safe for people who are pregnant and or breastfeeding. Can your guest provide some clarity?
So those studies are ongoing about pregnancy and breastfeeding. But we do know that, at least in the Pfizer trial, that there were several women that did become pregnant. There did not appear to be any obvious side effects. And again, everything is risk-benefit. So if you are a woman who is either a very high risk because of health conditions, or you have a job that puts you into contact with COVID patients, there is a discussion between the woman and her healthcare provider. And in fact, the American Obstetrical Committee really has endorsed that approach.
Mm-hmm. Joan says, how do we know the long-term effects the vaccine has on fertility?
Yeah, I don't think we've ever had a vaccine that has any effect on fertility, so that we don't expect there should be any with this one. But these are new vaccines, so we can wait and see. But I really think there's no worries in that regard.
Okay. Paul says, if vaccinated people are exposed to the virus, will they still shed, and can they infect others?
Yeah, that's a very important question to which we do not know the answer. The two trials for which we now have emergency use authorization, we're looking at symptomatic disease. So we don't know if it protects against asymptomatic infection. And that is important data that will be analyzed in these trials, but we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Similar to go ahead, Dr. Bennett.
I was just going to add, and that's one of the reasons why experts are strongly advising that we continue all of our other mitigation efforts, such as physical distancing, wearing masks, because we don't really have the answer to that question. And so we still need to, so long as there's as much disease in our community as there is currently, we need to be very careful, even if we are vaccinated.
Well, that leads me into my next question, Dr. Bennett, which is from Karen, who says, I'm wondering at what point we can relax social distancing measures.
It will be when most of the population has been vaccinated, but also, and really critically, when there's very little disease in the community. So if you think about it, a vaccine that's 95% effective, which is incredibly effective, is not effective in 5% of people, right? That means that they're still unprotected. And if we have a lot of disease in the community and a lot of people who are in that 5%, you still have a lot of spread of disease. So that's why it's critical that we all continue to take protective measures until we have high rates of vaccination and very low rates of disease.
Can you talk about that in terms of nursing homes as well? I know there are many people who are eager to see their family members who are in nursing homes, maybe, you know, bring them home to socialize or go there. What do they need to know about protecting their loved ones, even after their loved ones are vaccinated?
The same things we're saying about everyone else apply to those who are in nursing homes, which is simply that we don't know whether they can still acquire asymptomatic infection. We don't know if they're part of the 5% that doesn't respond to the vaccine. And therefore, we really still have to protect them until we have very low rates of disease in the community.
Here's a question from Mary. She says, if you've had COVID before, can you transmit it again to others? Hearing varying opinions that you're not contagious for 3 months and others saying that you're not ever contagious once you've contracted the virus.
Yeah, yet to be answered. There have been very few cases where individuals appear to have been reinfected with a different strain. So reinfection is not impossible. And therefore, are those people infectious? Quite possibly they are. So we really have to follow people longer. People have to remember this is a new disease. And so predicting what kind of immunity we will have and how long it will last is quite difficult.
Well, we are down to our last minute or so on this program. Dr. Falzy and Dr. Bennett, you are having so many important conversations in the community, and I know you're sharing information repetitively, which is so important and so valuable. If you're to leave our listeners with one thing to think about, you know, over the next few days as we head into the holiday, whether it's about vaccines or gathering or otherwise, Dr. Falzy, what would you say to our listeners?
Well, I think what I would say is the vaccines are coming. They look very safe and effective. So now is the time to not let down your guard. As much as we all want to go back to usual and have the holidays that we remember as children, we have to do things differently. We have to stay in our bubbles, use our distancing, use our masks, and be very careful because, you know, the help is on the way.
There's hope. There's hope, yeah. Everyone. There is a light at the end of this tunnel.
Right.
Dr. Bennett.
I would say exactly the same as Dr. Falzi. I think it's just a message we can't share often enough. We don't want to lose lots of loved ones between now and when everyone gets vaccinated. We want to ensure that we're protecting our population. And lastly, I would just say, you know, that lots and lots of people are working on getting you vaccinated, and we will get there.
Some hope from our experts this hour as we talk through these important issues. Dr. Nancy Bennett, Dr. Ann Falzi, thank you so much for all of your work throughout this pandemic and for taking the time to join us today. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Happy holidays to both of you. Thanks to all of our listeners who called in or left questions via email. We're going to continue these conversations. We know you have more questions. We know there's a lot of information we're still learning. So we'll keep doing that. In the meantime, stay with us. There's more Connections next.